You're listening to 95.7 FM, KDRT LP, Davis, California.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And this is Lois Richter on a, you know, my drapes are closed. I have no idea what it's like out there, but it's cold.
On a dreary, rainy Sacramento Valley day. I think that's the first time we've actually said that as we record the program so far at this end of 2024. It is, according to the National Weather Service, it's officially raining right now.
Backing up,
we are recording this broadcast on November 20, 2024 to air on November 21, 2024. And we're about to go into, looks like about 5 to 6 days of rain, which is the first major rain event that we've had here in Northern California. There's been a little bit here and a little bit there, washing the dust off the leaves of the trees and depositing that dust on my windshield. But this is going to actually be pretty significant. And as I say, 50 degrees as we're recording this late morning on the 20th, going up to a high today of 54 with showers. Okay. And tonight's temperature, bear in mind, we'll get to this later. So last night's or day before's temperature, we had a significant frost here in the valley. Tonight's temperature, low temperature, is going to be 47 degrees and showers. Thursday, I'll just go through these quickly because they're all pretty much the same. Thursday, 48. Friday, 56. Saturday, 59. Sunday, 56. Night temperatures, 49, 50, and 43. There's a, oh, you've probably seen the news reports, a giant, they're calling it a bomb cyclone, which is actually a technical term. Great big mass of air parked off of the Pacific Northwest. Tremendous winds, but they're all over the ocean. This would not be a good time to be out at sea west of the Pacific side of the United States. And it's going to be tapping into a significant amount of warm air at the tail end of this process. It's been very entertaining for the last day or two watching the different weather services, weather models, Ventusky, where you can actually, you know, track day to day exactly what they think is going to happen from one model to the next, trying to get a handle on this thing. It's huge. It's not moving fast at all. It's going to come in and hit the West Coast somewhere. And where it hits, it's going to be very, very, very wet. I've seen numbers approaching 8 to 10 inches of rain in places like Crescent City. Our friend who listens in Compton near Fort Bragg, you're going to get very wet. And then it's going to come in over the valley. And then the question is, where exactly? So just yesterday, we were going through the 3 or 4 different models you can track on Ventusky.com. And one of them showed over the whole period, 1.5 inches of rain in Sacramento. And another one showed 5 inches of rain in Sacramento. Seems like a big difference. It really just depends on how far south the thing pushes before it moves over us.
So if you're in Oregon, there's no question about it. There isn't any wavering between this part and that part. The only question is where the edge is going to be. And those little edges can make a big difference. Reading, you're going to get soaked.
Yeah.
Stockton, probably not so much.
Probably not. No, the line the Weather Service was indicating was Interstate 80. Actually, north of 80 was going to be wetter and south would be drier, which is, of course, the common pattern anyway, but it could be significant. Mm-hmm. First significant rainfall, and it's going to be warm at the end of this. You notice we had a frost yesterday morning, and we're not even going to be below 40 for the next several days. It's going to be wet, really saturating the soil. Great in many ways for gardening, except that you shouldn't be trying to dig in soil that's that soupy. So,
when you say frost, now there was a freeze warning, mm-hmm. and the temperature that they were warning about wasn't even below 32. So, why would they have a freeze warning?
Well,
it isn't going to be freezing.
Well, this worries me. Oh, it doesn't worry me, but it is a change that I've observed over the last, let's say, 30 years that I've been doing garden media, writing columns and being on the radio. It used to be that we would talk about a frost. That's a night where it's still and clear. There's no clouds and the earth of surfaces radiate their heat to the sky and they get cold enough to get to, let's say, 31, 30 degrees. You'll see visible frost. It'll damage the plants you expect will be damaged, like impatiens, you know, things like that. But it's really nothing to be concerned about. That's a frost. It can be significant, but it's a frost. A freeze, by definition, that we used to use, and that you'll find in my old articles on this subject, is a regional cold air mass that moves in, settles over an area, and makes temperatures well below average for at least a couple, or in some cases, several days. Long-timers here will remember a major freeze, 1990, 1998, 2005. I track these things. That's where it's not just one night at 31, it's several nights and could be below 31. It could be down into the upper 20s. That's a freeze. Regrettably, the National Weather Service now simply issues a freeze warning when there's going to be even just a significant frost. So the distinction has kind of gone away. So we end up having to jump in on conversations and say, no, this is not like going to kill your orange tree. This is just going to kill your impatience. And we'll talk a little bit more about that in just a moment.
Well, one of the things that people don't seem to understand is that one number that you get for what temperature is it going to be at night, that's an average or a norm or a mean or whatever you want to call it.
No, it's the absolute lowest. No, wait, stop there. It's the lowest. When they say it's going to be 31, it's going to get to 31. That's what they're predicting.
But what I'm trying to get to is if you go out in the world and you measure the temperature across the roof of the people across the street over their garage, there's no heat or anything, that will get frosted, even though in your yard where the grass is, it's warmer and it's not getting frosted. So right.
Weather stations have standards for where they're placed and how they're done. So it's telling you that out in the open, important mm-hmm. what you're saying, out in the open, 6 feet above the ground, in a particular type of weather station that's essentially prescribed for this purpose, it will be 31 degrees. In my farm, could be 29. In town, mm-hmm. you might not even get to 32. So microclimates, when it's a frosty night, I guess we're going to launch right into this. It's a frosty night. microclimates make a big difference. Having that little baby bougainvillea on the south-facing wall or east-facing wall, you may see no injury whatsoever. 8 feet away across a path against a fence open to the sky, it could get some leaf injury. So yes, if you had little sensors all over your yard that were feeding into your computer inside telling you what the temperatures are, you know, if you've listened to the Davis Garden Show, that the safe places are east and south facing walls with an overhang. We go through a process around Halloween at our nursery every year, going through the succulents, just as one category of plants about which there is some concern. Some of them, jade plants, aloe vera, some of the other aloes, a few others, calanchoas, would be injured out in the open, but are just fine 10 feet away against the wall of our nursery under the overhang. And if I had thermometers in those two places, there would probably be about a 3 to 4 degree difference on a frosty night. If a big old freeze is moving in, and you can see this on the radar, and you know there'll be descriptions of it, a 2 to 3 day cold weather event, we take those flats of those things that I just mentioned, jade plant, aloe vera, we bring them into the building before we leave for the day, because we find that if you leave them out after, you know, with a 2 or 3 or 4 day very cold air event, you can get enough injury that they certainly won't be saleable. That doesn't mean they're killed, but their retail quality is definitely diminished. So microclimates for gardeners make a huge, huge difference. And we'll talk a little bit more about this frost event in just a moment, but we've got all those PSAs and stuff we're supposed to do here. First of all, KDRT is community radio. That means it's public radio, and we rely on contributions from the public, which is you, to fund our operating costs. And by the way, we're coming up on 20 years on the air in 2025. So you'll be hearing more about that, let me tell you. But if you like what you hear, if you like the Davis Garden Show and all the other great programming here at KDRT, just head on over to kdrt.org and click on the support button. And there's all kinds of great programming here, but one that I want to mention that we never really talk about is the events outlook.
Well, it's not really an hour-long program.
No,
it's a thing that happens every single day at noon.
Yep. And it keeps you current on all the latest live music events in the Davis area. So if for some reason you're not glued to your speakers at those times, good news, the events calendar is always here for you online at kdrt.org, just a click away. You can find the events outlook at kdrt.org, and it's right there on the homepage. It does air, let's see, at noon and at 6 p.m. to keep you current on the latest live music events. That's the KDRT Events Outlook. That's a labor of love, by the way, on the part of some of the programmers. Mm-hmm. So kudos to those who are putting it together and keeping it current. I also want to mention the Davis Botanical Society. I don't think we've mentioned this one in
years. Is that the herbarium? Is that the same thing as the herbarium?
They're involved in it, yes. That the herbarium is where some of the events are hosted. I just want to mention this because one of their folks came in my nursery and we were chatting, and she mentioned that they had upgraded, and considerably improved the website of the UC Davis Center for Plant Diversity, which is where they host the information about the Davis Botanical Society events. So yes, herbarium is accurate because the URL for this is herbarium, H-E-R-B-A-R-I-U-M, herbarium.ucdavis.edu. You'll find a link to the Davis Botanical Society and a page of their events. For example, volunteer Sunday afternoons at the Center for Plant Diversity Herbarium. That's December 8th. And there's more information about these ongoing events and the presentations. January 23rd, Night at the Conservatory. You can go to these amazing greenhouses that I worked in the late 1970s, and it's a lecture series and open greenhouses. And I can tell you something, greenhouses are amazing after dark with the lights on. They are spooky and cool. I strongly suggest you check that one out, January 23rd, 2025. Herbarium, by the way, there's an amusing story about me. We were back watching my brother graduate from a prestigious East Coast Ivy League school. And we were strolling around the grounds of that prestigious Ivy League school. And I saw a sign that said herbarium. I was 16 years old, into plants. I thought, I like herbs. my brother didn't know anything about it. So we're just walking, let's go check it out. We're wandering around the building. And finally, a typical grad student looking sort of person, you know, scruffy hair and a beard, pokes his head out and goes, y'all looking for something? I said, yeah, we're looking for the herbarium. And he kind of laughs. He goes, it's not an herb garden. It's a place with pressed flowers. It's a collection of pressed flowers that they maintain for taxonomic purposes, I guess is the best way I could put it. So there was me wandering around Harvard looking for the herb garden. Herbarium is a reference collection of plants. And I don't know how they run them now. That would be an interesting topic, but it looks like a library, basically. So,
well, you can check it out on January 22nd. They're going to have the botanical tea in the herbarium.
Yes.
So that you can go in. They'll also have a talk at that time about California Plant Rescue Program.
Yeah.
So we'll let you know more about that when we get to January.
Yeah, we'll keep the Davis Botanical Society in our rotating roster of fascinating things on campus, like the raptors and all these other fascinating things that UC Davis does. Okay, let's move on to the mailbag or some topic that is first and foremost on your mind.
On my mind? Oh, well, you did mostly the frost update, but I think that it would be nice to know plants that are questionable in a frost and the fact that the cool season vegetables are just fine. They don't care if it freezes.
Yeah, the most common questions we typically get as frost is being reported in the forecast or has just happened. They're out there looking at lettuce and broccoli and things like that and thinking, oh, it's too late or these will be injured. No, they won't. So just a couple quick notes about this. This was a normal frost. We got to 31 degrees out in the outlying, out where the weather station is. People certainly saw visible frost. And by the way, this is right about when we usually get our first frost. Typically, I say for people, significant frost is usually Thanksgiving. And the last one significant is mid-February. Valentine's is easy to remember, although I have pictures of frost a week or so earlier than Thanksgiving. I have pictures of frost in March. It can happen. But that's kind of our main frost can happen season. I keep having people say, oh, we don't get frost anymore.
Yes, we do.
We get 2 to 3 dozen frosts every winter, even in a relatively mild winter like last year. And in fact, this is an interesting point for those who've lived here for a long time will understand what I'm about to talk about. We see more visible frost than we used to because we don't have fog anymore. The fog indeed has gone away. So on a clear night in the 1980s, fog would form. Well, fog acts as a thermal blanket and prevents frost. The day my daughter was born, which was in late November in the 1980s, we had frost on the ground and then fog formed above it. And I was noting as I drove at 30 miles an hour to the hospital, how rare that was to have frost and fog at the same time. And it was tule fog, a ground fog, a radiation fog. So that's why I was going 30 to 35 miles an hour on the freeway. I could see about 20 feet ahead of myself as I'm driving with a person in labor in the passenger seat. I thought, I'm going to go 30 miles an hour because I want to get there with all of us in good shape. All three, if necessary. And we made it, just for the record. But we had frost and fog at the same night. Normally, if you have fog, you don't get frost because the fog prevents it from happening. So anyway, this is when we normally get our first frost. Cold injury to plants is a function of how cold and for how long. And that's really important. A one night event where it got to 31 degrees at about 4 a.m., which is what happened, is really not a concern for the plants we typically grow here. I'm going to say something that should sound self-evident, but if it's considered hardy for this zone, you don't need to worry about a frost. I know that's sort of a tautology, as we say, but if you've looked it up and it's listed in the Sunset Garden Book for zone 14, you don't need to worry about frost. If it's listed for zone 15, but not 14, then you might need to be concerned about it. That used to be an easy thing to say, but most people don't have the Sunset Western Garden Book anymore. So essentially, the problem is the plants we're trying to grow that aren't really appropriate. And that the most common questions we get are about things like citrus, which are fine in most cases. We'll get back to that. Bougainvilleas, mandevillas, things, hibiscus, things like that. Most subtropicals will be unaffected by a one-night frost event at 31 degrees. When the weather forecast, which it did not in this case, but when the weather forecast shows temperatures below 30, 31 for a few nights in a row, like a cold event that's going to go on for 2, 3, 4 nights, doesn't matter how high the daytime temperature gets, I'm talking about the nighttime lows, you may wish to protect some subtropicals that are considered hardy here, but that are young. So in their first winter in the ground, you can get injury to citrus, bougainvilleas, and things like that. And they don't have any wood yet. Wood protects growth buds. Green tissue usually doesn't. So by the second winter, most of those plants are fine. Now, if you're listening to us out in the country, bear in mind, like us, you know, out in the farm or out near Winters or in Yolo County, someplace like that, not in town, you could get down to 25 degrees on a very cold night or a couple of very cold nights in a row. That can do pretty significant injury. I have lost young citrus on my farm when that happens, if I haven't protected them. Bougainvilleas, we would get to 25 degrees. We get to 25 degrees almost every winter on our farm, just for the record, at least once or twice. That starts to do injury to semi-hardwood, and your young plant is even more likely to be injured, but very unlikely in town. Just all the aspects of living in town makes a 2, 3, 4 degree temperature difference just because of all the concrete and the protection of high trees and the buildings and all that kind of thing. And again, the microclimates around your house provide at least a couple of degrees of protection. So if you're growing something that you know is not actually really hardy here, and hopefully you bought it at a place where the garden center employees told you that, you should cite that against a south or east facing wall. I mention this for all of you who are buying Haas avocados, for example, because every chain in Northern California that happens to have a garden department, we're talking Home Depot, places like that, sells a Haas avocado. That's the main avocado they sell. It's not hardy here. When people ask me for Haas avocado, I say, it's not hardy here. Would you like me to order it with no guarantee that it'll survive the first winter? And they usually go, oh, it's not hardy here. I saw it at fill in the blank.
But you can plant Mexican avocados and be just fine.
Right. So you should ask about the ones that are hardy. And if you're really into subtropical fruit, you know, there's a great group that'll give you that kind of information. So if you know that it's not really hardy here and you've got one anyway, like a lot of the dwarf avocados are basically like Haas, find that south facing wall, find that east facing wall, even better if there's an overhang. And the first winter, you might want to just drape some frost blanket over it to just give another couple degrees of protection. That's just one of the things you can do. But be aware of the plants you have that are marginal, dragon fruit, hibiscus, not going to survive most cases anyway, mandevillas, which are actually diplodenias, and so on.
So if I were to get, which I'm not going to because I don't have a sunny enough spot to put it, but if I were going to get an avocado, which eventually is going to want to be out there in the sun, if I planted it in a half barrel or a pot or something for the first couple years until the trunk hardened up, would that help or would that make it worse?
That helps. That's exactly what I did to get a jacaranda tree, which is marginal here when they're young, but hardy enough once established. I grew it in a large plastic tub, the equivalent of a barrel. Mm-hmm. On the south-facing corner of my house, my little subtropical corner, which makes, mm-hmm. in my case, 5 or 6 degrees temperature difference. And there's a plug nearby. If it really came down to it, I could even get a little extra heat out there. And I grew it for 2 years until it was about a 1-inch caliper and was woody. And then I felt mm-hmm. comfortable planting it out in the ground, and it's done fine ever since. So you asked me, does jacaranda grow here? I'll say, well, the young trees are tender, but they can be hardy once established. Same thing. I'm not going to say that for Guatemalan avocado for one reason. Takes about 5 to 8 years for any avocado to finally flower and fruit. All right, that's a long mm-hmm. wait. And we always want people to know that when they want to order avocados. And then every time we have freeze injury, it sets it back. Not completely 5 to 8 years, but at least 2 to 3, very commonly. You get significant injury, so it has to regrow and grow another year and starts to flower. Well, we get these cold events every few years. And so you're going to have a lot of years where it's not really going to be flowering or fruiting. Far better, as long as we're talking about avocados, to buy one of the Mexican avocados, such as Mexicola, Stewart, Zutano. Mexicola can go down to 19 degrees. Zutano and Stewart down to the low 20s. You can grow them in zones 9A, not just 9B. So you'll do well with those. They can be out in the open. Even with those, if you hear we're having a regional freeze event, I don't know how you're going to hear that with the Weather Service failing to distinguish these things, but listen to us. If you're going to hear we're having a major freeze event, I like to stick, having been burned on this, I like to stick a few stakes in the ground around a young lime or avocado when I first plant it, just in case I'm going to have to run out there and drape some frost blanket over it on a couple nights in a, you know, a cold event such as we do get periodically. That's what you would have to do with a young tree that's mostly green. Even the Mexican ones might be vulnerable in that situation. But moving on, the majority of our questions when we have a frost event are about citrus. So limes are the ones that you need to be most concerned about. Mexican lime, which I don't sell because of this, is tender. It's not hardy even when established, and it needs protection kind of forever. It's the classic bartender's lime, the key lime. That's all the same plant. Mexican lime is the common name it's sold under. It 32 degrees injures it pretty badly. The Bearss lime, B-E-A-R-S-S, sometimes called the Tahitian lime, is hardy enough to grow in the interior parts of Northern California. Young plants might be injured, so protect them when you first put it in that first winter, but it is hardy enough to grow here. And once established, you shouldn't have any concern. Lemon trees, which people have and their fruit is coloring up and they're dripping with fruit right now, they are generally hardy enough for us not to have to worry about them. I know people who cover them. The fruit can be injured below 30 degrees, particularly if it's on the outer part of the tree where the fruit itself is literally open to the sky. That fruit, that one lemon, might be injured by a cold night, losing its heat, dropping down. It'll be desiccated by the injury, so it'll be spoiled by it. So if you're really concerned about it, they're ripe enough. You could pick some of the ones on the outer part of the tree, but on a normal frosty night, their peel is enough to protect them. We're talking about when we're getting colder than that. So don't pick unless you really have to. Yeah, I can guarantee you, you know, citrus growers, when a freeze event is coming in, such as we had in December 1990, they're rushing through their fields in the middle of the night with their spectrophotometers, trying to figure out what the sugar content is on the oranges and the lemons and figure out whether they can just go ahead and harvest them all, because they won't get sweeter off the tree, particularly not enough for market purposes. So if you pick them, you got a bunch of lemons at that stage of development. Case of lemons, I suppose we don't care that much, but in the case of oranges or mandarins, it would be a little disappointing. Grapefruits, pomelos, oranges, all fine. Don't worry about them, even under an unusually cold event. Mandarins, surprisingly cold hardy. Mine have gone down to 19 degrees with no problem. Didn't even injure the fruit, interestingly. Kumquats, absolutely hardy. Don't worry about them. And yuzu, if you happen to be growing that sort of fancy gourmet citrus called yuzu, it can go down to 15 degrees with no problem. There's a reason it's grown in Korea and Northern Japan. It is one of the cold hardiest citrus that we use. Now, it's sour and somewhat bitter. It's got a very aromatic flavor. We'll talk more about citrus another time. And yuzu is used where it grows because it's got that really rich flavor, but it's sort of a specialized thing. But it's very cold hardy. So there are citrus that can go down colder than anything we're likely to get here. The limes are the ones you need to be concerned about, especially if you inadvertently got a Mexican lime. Cool season vegetables are fine. Flowers, the pansies, violas, snapdragon, stock, sweet alyssum, all those things are fine. Your basil is probably dead now. Your summer savory is probably gone, but I've read someone commenting they're going to go out and harvest all their herbs before this frosty weather. Well, chives go dormant, so you might want to snag some of those. Tarragon goes completely dormant, so you might want to snip some of that. All the other herbs I could think of are either cold tolerant, like cilantro, actually prefers cool and cold conditions, or are perfectly cold hardy, chamomile, lemon balm, marjoram, mint, oregano, rosemary, it's blooming now, looks great, sage, thyme, all of your common kitchen herbs except basil are perfectly hardy plants. You can just leave them alone, don't worry about it. You don't have to do anything to them. Perfectly fine to harvest some, but you don't need to worry about them being killed back. So that those are the ones we get a lot of questions about. And we talked about succulents, it's jade plants and their relatives, some of the aloes, but especially the most popular one, the aloe vera. So we always want to mention that one. Most of them are hardy. That one's tender. Some euphorbias would be injured if they're out in the open. So it's important if you're a succulent collector to learn which ones are hardy and which ones aren't. Cactus, almost all cactus are perfectly cold hardy. The exception are the tropical ones, Rypsilis, and the holiday cactus that you'll be buying shortly, Zygocactus. Those are a little bit tender, although they're actually fine outside, just like jade plant, in a sheltered location.
So you've been talking about when it gets down to 31 and then below 30 and then below 25. So how have our below 25 years been? I mean, is that something that happens all the time?
Below 25 takes you from zone 9B to zone 9A in the USDA zone designation. And in my opinion, if you live in an outlying area, you're zone 9A. And if you live closer into town, you're zone 9B. We get below 25. I just went back and looked at a couple dozen years of records, and we've been below 25 at the Dixon Weather Station 66 times in the last 25 years, and it happens almost every year. Winters, likewise, not every year, but nearly every year. In Davis, I went back 25, 30 years of records, and it's only happened 7 or 8 times, which to me is not often enough to say, all right, Davis, you're in zone 9A. Those were freeze events. And so we're typically in town at the Davis weather station. It's rare to get below 25, and so it's not as much of a problem, but it has happened, and it has happened as recently as a couple of years ago. And if you're in an outlying area, it definitely happens. And so, well, the USDA zones are changing, and there's no question about that, especially back east. The mid-Atlantic states, the upper parts of the South, and so far, there has been significant movement of the USDA climate zones, which are based on 5 and 10 degree increments of temperature. Much less difference in California because of our topography. And we remain, those of us on farms and such, in zone 9A. Keep that in mind if you're choosing a citrus or an avocado. And again, a lot of the plants that we're talking about are things that I really wish we could just say when you're buying, hey, be aware, you're likely to lose this. Hibiscus, you know, everybody loves the tropical hibiscus. Okay, plant them, but you know, I'm give you a 50-50 that it'll get through its first winter. I was in a yard on a consultation earlier in the fall. They had mature hibiscus against the fence. They had been in the ground for obviously 8 to 10 years. Tropical hibiscus against the fence. And I'm looking at the spot. I took a couple of pictures of them. They looked great. It was an area where it was east of the house with a concrete walk and a fence. And it just clearly traps enough heat to keep those, to get them through the winter. I don't know what they look like in January and February, but the plants were obviously established woody tropical hibiscus. I will not tell you, based on that one sample size of N equals one, that you can grow tropical hibiscus in Davis, because most of them freeze. But that's an example of something people love to buy, and that they just need to understand it's really out of our zone. Zone benders, you know who you are, all right? You know who you are, and you know that you need to do a little research before you put something truly tropical or even subtropical in some cases in the ground.
And Lois got around that for many years by putting it in a large pot on wheels just outside my sliding glass door that faces south. Mm-hmm. And in the summertime, it was out there. It was glorious. And then in the wintertime, it rolled inside the door and lived in my house for a couple of months and then rolled back out in the summer. And we did that for probably 4 or 5 years before the plant just got too big.
So you're moving it like 5 feet, maybe 10 feet. Yeah.
It had wheels. It was easy.
I had a customer who had a plumeria, which is definitely not hardy here, in El Macero, and her house faced east and giant sliding glass door. And so it lived on the patio until about Halloween is the what I had suggested. That's generally my recommendation. And then she's rolled it in and it literally rolled, you know, 10 feet, but it obviously was inside now and still got almost exactly the same light as before. So you just know that you find those little microclimates. We know someone who's growing dragon fruit, which has become really kind of trendy and popular right now. It's a cactus. It has amazing fruit. To me, it's mostly mild and sweet, but they're pretty and they're interesting. And it's a strange plant. It's a sprawling, climbing cactus, believe it or not. It's not really hardy here, USDA zone 10, but this person has it on her south facing wall and just drops a sheet over it when it gets cold. So you can grow them. You just need to be aware of those things. I just wish there was more information on the plants that are sold in the mass merchandisers. Yeah, I understand why tropical hibiscus are so popular. There's hundreds of varieties, incredible color range. These blended colors are astonishing, and they're definitely worth it. They're selling them all over the country. They're selling them in places where people absolutely know they aren't hardy. But here, I think people think they might be. You like a hibiscus? We talk about them all the time on the show. But if you like a hibiscus, there's hardy ones. Just buy those instead. But they don't come in that amazing color range yet. I can assure you, plant breeders have discovered that there is a market for those deciduous hibiscus, the Southern Bells and the Dixie Bells and all that series. There's more and more of them coming out as shorter, more compact, bigger flowers. Maybe they'll manage to make a breakthrough and get something other than red, pink, and white into that mix. But anyway, hibiscus is sort of a special case.
So looking at our mailbag, we have a message from Jenny. Hello, Redwood Barn team. I saw Don's Facebook post about freeze, but it didn't mention fig. Yeah. Now we're talking about the outdoor fig tree. I bought this fig tree a couple weeks ago. The leaves seem to have recently shriveled a bit. Is this due to frost or cold weather? Should I bring it inside? Should I repot it now? Thanks you for the advice in advance. And she sent a picture of this little stick with these...
curling up leaves.
Now, Don, I thought fig trees were deciduous.
Yeah, they are. And this is something I actually appreciate this note because I like to try and mention this on the air for a couple of species of plants that people buy and grow here that do this. Figs, Vitex, the chaste tree is another example. I was just trying to think of another one that does this. They don't turn yellow. They just curl up and drop. I mean, yes, they are deciduous. Yes, what it's doing is normal. It doesn't announce it the way deciduous plants from further north latitudes do, you know, turn color and tell you that they're doing it. They just look like there's something wrong, seriously. And we get this question every year, actually. It is what it is doing is the way it goes deciduous and they don't turn color. Now, there's people listening who are growing figs in much colder climates because figs are really popular to grow. They'll fruit even when you're like nurturing them in containers and burying them in the winter or bring them into your garage or whatever. In those places, as you know, they are frost tender, freeze tender plants. Fig trees can go down to 20, 15 degrees with no problem here and come back just fine from that. There are figs on my property that were planted here in the 1950s and have been through major freeze events, and they're yellowing somewhat, curling up their leaves and dropping their leaves now. And as I mentioned, the Vitex or chaste tree, which is becoming increasingly popular, does the same thing. They just look like something is wrong. They're just dropping their leaves. Nothing to be concerned about. That is normal. But thank you for the reminder to tell people their figs are doing what is normal. The other tree we often get a question about this time of year is Japanese maple. I bought a Japanese maple from you in the summer and it was looking great. Now the leaves are looking rough and they're falling off. They are deciduous as well.
Deciduous.
Yeah, a lot of people don't know that apparently when they buy them. So they are deciduous. And as years go by, your Japanese maple, as it gets established, is likely to have pretty nice fall color. They're one of the trees that are just coming into fall color now. So it'll announce it better than it does in its first couple of years in the ground. But yes, they are deciduous. I mean, I remember getting that question about crepe myrtles. People would plant them in the summer and it's turning yellow and dropping all its leaves. You know, you're in the nursery business, you kind of chuckle to yourself, but we all learned it somewhere first, so we should make fun of people. Okay.
So I sent Don a picture today of the Japanese maple bonsai that I have in my in my driveway. Well, it's, you know, it's six Japanese maples that are taller than the garage, and they're all in one pot. They're in a half barrel.
It's a pre-bonsai. It has not been treated like a bonsai by anyone.
It's root-bound. It's root-bound, yes, sure.
For sure. Yeah. And it has a nice fall color.
They had beautiful fall color. Yeah, and they weren't all the same. They were seedlings that I had taken from the other location. Yep. And they weren't all quite the same color, but right, they were not beautiful.
So they're not clones, so they will be variable for fall color, and that's actually important to know. And by the way, fall color is continuing here in the Sacramento Valley, and some of the things that are turning color now. Of course, the Chinese pistache are finally peaking past their peak. I still have some that are turning, you know, the peak of their color, but most of them are dropping their leaves. My cottonwood is dropping its leaves and so forth. But on my property, the fall color we're getting right now is Japanese maples are just turning color. My ginkgo is just turning color. It's a few days away from being spectacularly golden. There are a lot of ginkgos around Davis in full fall color right now. So other maples are also beginning to show some color. In my backyard is one that it's not a tree that I recommend for a variety of reasons, but my little leaf linden is glowing yellow right now. So there is still fall color continuing through November and sometimes into early December. Some of the oaks don't turn color until we get into December, the red oak group, but we still have fall color going. I'm getting questions about, you know, why this pistache turned color and that one didn't, and that can get a little complex. But the key question is, was it grown from seedling grown, or did you buy a cultivar that was grafted? The grafted one is always Keith Davey, pretty much. That's the only one in the trade. It has reliable red fall color genetically. So if it doesn't have really nice fall color in your situation, that would be an environmental factor. Like you had it in a courtyard that stays warmer and doesn't give it the temperature difference that it needed to turn color. But as to the differences in color among your Japanese maples or among the pistache that I planted from seedlings, that's genetic. That's just the base, you know, well, that's what you get when you do them from seed. And I think actually personally, I think that's great because you get a little more diversity that way. Your barrel there is probably ready for someone to adopt it because it's...
I'm hoping someone will come along and go, oh, I want a Japanese maple bonsai. Oh, give me that barrel. Because I don't want to kill the things, but you know, you can't really transplant them very well at this point.
Well, with any tree, yeah, with any tree, there's a point of diminishing returns where you can't keep going up to a bigger container and a bigger container. That goes for figs that you're growing in containers indoors, for example. That goes for that one plant you've had, you've been nurturing all these years, but you know is too tender to put outside. Well, what are you going to do when it gets root bound? You can keep a plant root bound for an amazingly long time as long as you give it the water and the nutrients that it needs. You can, you know, which may be daily watering here in the Sacramento Valley, and very likely to be daily watering here in the Sacramento Valley during the summer. And nutrients is actually easy. You can just top dress the container with an enriched potting soil, or you can use any kind of soluble fertilizer, whatever you prefer to do. But it will run out of nutrients, and so the plant will show deficiencies and be anemic looking unless you give it something in the way of fertilizer. Allowing the leaves to build up in the barrel actually helps with that because it recycles some of the nutrients. But yes, at some point you should, what really is going to happen in your case, I think the barrel is going to fall apart. At that point, you'll have an issue.
Okay, next. Now, Kathy and Davis writes, attached our photos of leaves from two of my fiddle leaf figs. One, the first is the one in the south window, which the question is it getting sunburned? And there's a picture of the leaf, the plant in the window, and a close-up of the damage to the leaf. So why don't we start with that?
What's interesting is that fiddle leaf fig, like all of the indoor figs, where it grows in nature, it grows in full sun. Okay? They are 30 to 40-foot trees in full sun. In Southern California, all these different figs are routinely planted as ornamental trees, sometimes causing some buyer's remorse because of their roots, but they grow in the frost-free climates in full sun. So why would a fig with its leaf in a window show sunburn? Because I do get this question, it's full sun through a window. Isn't that too much for the plant? If the plant gets drought stressed at any time, the waxy layer that protects the leaf thins out. And plants that are exposed to direct sun under periods of drought stress will scorch. The same plant adequately watered would not. So it's not a problem of it being in too much sun. It's a problem that at some point it probably went dry. This goes for landscape shrubs. Landscape shrubs that have thick leaves that have a waxy coating like Pittosporum tobira, Ligustrum, all the privets that are grown. they're fine. They're pretty drought tolerant, but if they get drought stressed and there's direct sun on them, let's say coming from the west, they'll scorch. It's cosmetic, but it can really make them unsightly. So I think what you're dealing with here is that you didn't keep it adequately watered when there was direct sun on the leaf through the window. This plant should be able to take full sun. So that tells us that there was probably a watering stress involved in this particular case.
And all the other leaves on the plant look fine.
Yep. Well, looking at the picture, it's the one that's closest into the window. So
it's the one that's faced, you know, laying down, getting. Okay.
Now, as a retailer, I hate to sell this plant.
Yes.
Everything goes wrong with fiddle leaf fake.
Yes, it does.
They don't come into my store anymore. But this is not a disease or a pest problem. It's also not that funny red coloration that the new growth has on it that often concerns people. There's little red spots that just disappear after the new growth fully opens out. That's actually just a natural physiological phenomenon. But there are leaf diseases that they can get that cause, you know, areas to brown and die. And of course, if the light changes or you look at them cross-eyed or you play the wrong kind of music, they drop leaves and they're just famous for it. So they went through a vogue right around the beginning of the pandemic and people were buying them like crazy. And then, you know, those of us who sell them just sort of got exhausted with discussing these problems with people as they progressively looked worse after they took them home. Yeah. All the ficus will drop leaves due to environmental change. But if it's a ficus benjamina with 500 leaves on it and even drops 100 of them, the plant still looks good. Your fiddle leaf fig you buy has got like 12 leaves on it. So if three of them drop, you fret.
And the leaf, if I were to take the leaf that fell off and hold it up in front of my face, you could not see my head.
They're big.
They're huge.
So the symptoms are very visible. So it's really just a cosmetic thing, but it's ugly enough that it's a concern.
Okay. So then the third picture is a leaf on the same plant, which has holes in it. Now, they're random, but there's holes in it.
Yeah, well, there's a variety of bacterial diseases that are present on houseplants when you buy them or are present on them when the new one comes in and sits nearby. And they will cause some damage to a leaf. And a very common thing after that is that part of the damaged part falls out. Mm-hmm. So it's like shot hole fungus on fruit trees. It's caused by a disease, but it looks like something chewed on it. People will bring in leaves like this picture and say, there must be something eating my plant, but it's indoors. No, it's not anything eating it. You can see on this third picture, there's an area where it's fallen out, where you have a hole, and an area next to it where it hasn't yet fallen out is what it looks like.
Papery. No, it's a different color. One is on the wall and one is on the window.
So what you normally get,
they're both holes.
The first stage is remnant tissue that's been damaged. You often see a bit of a halo around the injury. I don't really see it in this picture, but an area of infection. And then everything in that area dies, that tissue dies, and then gradually falls out. Sometimes all at once, so it looks like something chewed on it. Sometimes it sort of withers away, so you can see it happening. It was not caused by a organism biting it. It was caused by a pathogen killing some tissue, stopping its progress in the leaf, thankfully, and then you just end up with a hole. So that's basically
there. If the edge of the hole still has the thing on it, should I be like washing it off with
I doubt if washing it, or something? If it's a bacteria, I doubt if washing it off is going to do any good or harm. I mean, you can wash it off following your general practice, but I would be cautious about keeping it too humid. That does work. Okay. This is where, that's almost never an issue here, by the way, but there are places where it could be a concern.
So in the same leaf, in that same picture, you see at the bottom where there's a line where it literally looks like a caterpillar chewed its way in a few inches. Is that the same thing?
That looks like mechanical injury. That just got brushed or bumped by someone is most likely, although it could be the same thing. I remember a very early consultation I did. I didn't realize I was going out there to look at houseplants. I usually would be going out to look at people's yards. There was this long fissure in a leaf of one of the many houseplants that I had to look at. It looked like the leaf had gotten folded over, broken, and then scarred along the line. What caused this? Is this a disease? And I said, no, this is mechanical injury. And she looked at me, obviously that was jargon. So she didn't know what it meant. I said, what does that mean? I mean, that means something or someone broke the leaf, flattened it, bumped it. She goes, you mean someone's mutilating my plants? Across the room, the 14-year-old got up and walked out of the room.
Okay.
So mechanical injury is often followed by scarring along the point of the fold or the break, and bacteria can get in any of those points. So you can see little points in this picture where it appears right down at the very bottom that a bacteria got into the break and has progressed a little bit into the leaf and then stopped. Plants will wall off diseases and pathogens pretty readily. And if the environmental conditions that favored the infection go away, that'll just be that. It doesn't look like it's spreading, but it looks like it was just mechanical injury.
Okay. So the fourth picture is a leaf from a different plant. This other plant is not in direct sunlight, but it's close to that window. And it just dropped one yellowed leaf. Now, the rest of the leaves are all green.
It's fall.
I'm assuming that it's fall and it's falling. Is that right?
Well, it's dropping a leaf because of lower light status, very likely. And, you know, as the days get shorter, even indoor plants are affected by that. If you happen to put a grow light on it, I suppose that would help. And it is interesting. I'm not going to post this picture, but it's yellow with a bunch of mottling on it. Plants differ as to how they exactly senesce. You know, they usually form an abscission layer, and then the chlorophyll starts to break down. That's true even on plants that don't turn, you know, beautiful fall color. But there's parts of the leaf that are unaffected. And then various opportunistic pathogens, usually bacteria, sometimes fungus, will come along and just start disintegrating, you know, composting the leaf like they're supposed to. They're just doing their job. So you see areas on this leaf that look like they're sort of rotting. That's happening because the leaf is dying. It didn't cause the leaf to die, I guess is the best way I can put that. This is a normal, older, fiddly fig leaf that senesced, fell off, and is beginning to compost right on someone's desk.
Well, I put it in the compost pile already. Okay. So the sunburnt leaf on that other one, should I cut that off or just leave it there?
Completely your choice. It's still photosynthesizing, so it's not harming the plant. It just is going to be unsightly because of the burn.
And if you remove a leaf that it isn't normally falling off, then it hasn't made that abscission layer. And when you do that, should you cut it like right at the stem or out from the stem, or does it matter?
You can actually just grasp the petiole, the base of the leaf, and pull down and it will snap off.
That's exciting.
Okay.
let's get on to something else. Enough about this fiddle leaf fig.
Yeah, I mean, figs are famous indoor plants, and this one's come and gone, but people still do buy the other ones, and they get very nervous when they drop leaves. Dropping leaves for trees indoors is relatively normal. The question is, what percentage are dropping? Is it a sign of stress, or is it just like a normal adjustment to lower light status? We're about to go into a period of 5 or 6 days where we're not going to see the sun. So if you don't have a grow light near your plant, it's going to go get a little torpid.
Well, that's okay. Yeah. I have one in the atrium that is, gosh, I don't know how tall that thing is, but, and I don't worry about it. And it dropped leaves all the time, just a little bit here and a little bit there.
This is why we don't think ficus are great starter plants. Even a healthy ficus is dropping leaves and people get concerned about it. And they always get told, whenever they go to almost any other plant business, they get told they're overwatering.
Well, this thing is bone dry. I am underwatering.
The go-to answer in plant stores, you're overwatering. Okay.
Okay, so we got a couple of little notices that Don's put in here. One says, there's a magnolia tree flowering in Berkeley in mid-November. Why is it doing that?
Well, and we see pictures of fruit trees popping out some flowers out of season. I have a lilac that I'm actually probably going to take out. It's one of the Descanso hybrids. It always tries to bloom in the fall, and it, you know, you would think, oh, cool, your lilac's blooming in the fall. No, it's weird. It's out of order. This is disorderly, and I don't like that. So I'm probably going to take it out.
And it probably doesn't succeed in blooming either.
It sort of does. That's the thing. And then it hardly blooms in the spring because all those flower buds opened in the fall. My understanding, it was a lovely picture, by the way, of a Magnolia soulangeana, the saucer magnolia, putting out one of its very pretty pink petal, you know, the pink back of the petal is pink, the inside is white. In mid-November, someone was visiting Berkeley. Well, Berkeley had a major heat wave in late September, just so you know. They had a record-setting heat wave in late September. So why does that matter? Well, my understanding is that many deciduous shrubs and trees, which have entered their quiescent period of late summer, which is a type of dormancy prior to leaf drop, can be triggered to bloom by stress from drought or extreme heat. And I've read all the science of this. It's an internal hormonal thing, but it really depends on what stage of flower bud initiation that plant is in. And they vary quite a bit. I mean, woody plants, shrubs, trees from temperate zones, places where they have normal seasonal cycles, go through predictable stages of when they initiate flower buds, when they go into late summer dormancy, which we call quiescence, and then full dormancy, which is when the leaves drop like they're supposed to. And both of those types of dormancy, the summer dormancy and the full dormancy, can be broken by cues from the environment. Stress can affect quiescence. That's the early dormancy. Chilling hours affect the true dormancy. You know, you get enough chilling hours and you only need, say, 300 or 400, the plant will try to bloom. In the case of quiescence, it's probably a function of how far along the flower buds were in their development when they were subjected to the stress. So some plants will respond to stress by trying to bloom, and others, the flower buds aren't far enough along. They might be injured, but they won't try to flower. And species are wildly variable. Even within the same species, you'll have variability as with respect to varieties. So, well, fruit growers would be concerned about this because it could affect the yields of fruit. Nut growers are aware of this with respect to particular types of nuts and when they can't be allowed to get drought stress. We'll experience this more as climate extremes occur. There will be concerns with certain types of food crops. And with respect to ornamentals, it'll just be one of those things that people observe. You get a heat wave in Berkeley in September, the magnolias might try and bloom in November because their flower buds were far enough along. The plant was stressed. Stress releases ethylene gas and interacts with other hormones within the plant and triggers bloom. So that's what's going on, but it's almost surely a relationship to environmental stress. With respect to agricultural crops, for example, if almonds are drought stressed in late summer, the flower buds which are initiating won't develop properly, and they can have significant yield reductions if the orchards are stressed in late August or September, which is right about when they're just finishing up harvest. So you'll typically watch, say, harvest everything, clean the orchard, and then do a major irrigation. And then oftentimes that's it for the season. They just make sure they're not drought stressed going into the fall. With walnuts, okay, another nut crop, but totally unrelated, they learned many years ago that if they're drought stressed midwinter, they will not yield well, and the yield will be significantly reduced. So I have watched as the irrigation district has come out, when there were a lot of walnut orchards around me, many of them are gone, but many still there, would come out in January during drought years. A few years ago, we went through the entire month of January without a single rainstorm. So the walnut growers were opening up the valves and irrigating their dormant trees because they knew that if they didn't do that, it would affect their yield. So this is a complex subject, but it's almost entirely related to environmental, or what we might call, weather cues to the plant.
All right. Wow, that was a long digression there, Don.
Yeah.
Let's go back to the mailbag. Chuck in Carmichael is writing, "Hi, Don and Lois. I took several cuttings of hydrangeas last spring, and they seem to have rooted really well. They have put on plenty of new growth. They are currently growing in quart-sized containers. Am I able to plant these in the garden now, or should I transfer them to larger containers and wait for them to get bigger before planting in the ground? I appreciate your advice and look forward to your show each week. Thank you very much."
Yeah, that's an interesting one because they should be going dormant. We were, of course, warm. Well, we were 102 degrees on the first weekend in October, and we're only 6 weeks away from that. They should be going dormant, and I would be a little concerned about just putting them out in the open if they're in a sheltered location right now, abruptly going into cold weather. My guess is they would go dormant properly, but I don't know for sure. So if it were me, and I'd really love it if you would do this, take half of them and put them in the ground, keep half of them close to your house, and check in with us in next summer and let us know how they did, because they are, yes, they're... We had an interesting phenomenon. We brought in some of our bare root, as they call it. The dormant plants are now being shipped out in long pots, lilacs, berries, grapes, things like that. They arrived 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago. Wow, that's early. They're not even close to dormant. Yeah, and the lilacs came in and have already broken bud and are growing. And we're looking at them and going, yeah, that's what we said. Uh-oh. Now what? They look fine. They look perfectly healthy, but they're growing in a way they should be doing in March. So we're watching those. And if people do buy them, we want them to understand we guarantee these plants because we're not quite sure what's going on here. They harvested early. They put them into the containers. They shipped them all out. And then it was still warm. So they just broke dormancy and grew. My guess is they'll just drop those leaves and go dormant again when we get cold, and they'll probably, there's enough buds further down that they'll flush out and everything will be fine. But putting a growing plant that should be deciduous into the ground while it's growing late season, I'm a little worried about that. If it were mine, and I really cared about those hydrangeas, I'd keep them in the containers for now. But if there are enough of them, I would experiment, which I like to do. So I'd stick some of them out there and keep the others near the house. Let us know what you decide. We'll be curious.
So since they're starting to go dormant, or should be, you wouldn't need to transfer them into a bigger pot. You could just leave them where they are and see if they stop leafing out. I'm wondering if Chuck is keeping them indoors or in a shed, or
probably in a shelter,
you know, in a greenhouse or something like that. Maybe that's why they aren't going dormant. Maybe they're just not getting cold.
A sheltered location would be doing that. Also, again, we were, you know, very warm 5-6 weeks ago. So we have a lot of things in production at our nursery at all times, on mist benches, warm benches, greenhouses. And we look at them and try to think whether we need to move them around. I've got a whole lot of things in my backyard right now. As you know, I have many, many things in containers. I'm about to go out and move some things around, the things that I'm concerned about, whether they need sheltering. I have some old, some interesting peppers, for example, which are from high elevation, so they should be relatively cold hardy, but I'm not 100% sure. So I'm going to move them closer to the house. I think I'd probably keep these where they are, Chuck, and just see how it goes. But it would be interesting to stick a couple in the ground and see what happens. Typically, when something breaks dormancy early, that new growth just goes away one way or another, falls off, freezes, whatever. And then there are enough growth buds stored in the plant further down to sprout out at the appropriate time. But, you know, I would cut your losses, have some of them close to the building.
Okay, well, it is November. Even though it's late in November, it's still November. And so I want to look at the November 2024 calendar.
Okay.
Now, there's a whole bunch of stuff in there, and there's pictures and everything. So let me digress and say first, hey, Don, what's blooming in your yard?
Oh, well, what looks really showy right now, I mean, other than the fall color we keep talking about, my rosemary is just coming into bloom. And if you think rosemary is boring and some common landscape shrub, some of them are, but some of them have very, very showy blue flowers. All rosemary, there's one white cultivar, all the rest of them are blue, violet, lavender, pale blue, vivid. They vary somewhat, but they're all in that color range. And I really recommend, if you're doing a low water landscape, or you have a vegetable garden, you want something near it to make it sort of integrate better into your landscape from a design standpoint, rosemary is one of your best choices. And two of them in particular, Tuscan Blue and Irene, have very showy, vivid blue flowers, violet if you prefer. Blue, in the nursery trade, we use the term blue for anything on the purple spectrum, okay? If you haven't learned that by now, blue is the holy grail of plant breeders because it's so rare in flowers. It's one of the least common colors. True blue is extremely rare. So if it's purple, we call it blue. But the Irene and Tuscan Blue are very vivid violet flowers. They really stand out in the winter time. I have them, you know, I have an Irene next to Ingramire, one of the other prostrate forms of rosemary, and it's pale, pale, pale blue. It's kind of okay, but Irene is showy.
So we're going to end the show with another garden quote. The best time to plant a tree was 25 years ago. The second best time to plant a tree is today.
You've been listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore
and Lois Richter here at KDRT LP 95.7 in Davis, California.